Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on PBS Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country, the series Independent Lens is airing a riveting documentary called Tower. And this film takes us back just over 50 years to what amounts to America's first mass shooting. It occurred on the 1st of August, 1966, on the campus of the University of Texas in Austin, when a lone gunman took hostage, in a sense, the tower that was at the center of that campus and began shooting at innocent people as they passed by. It was a nightmare like America had never seen before. And the ordeal lasted for about 90 minutes before two police officers were able to take him down and end the siege. It is remarkable the way in which this new documentary film takes us back to that terrifying day. I am very, very pleased to be able to speak with its director and one of its producers, Keith Maitland, who has quite a long resume, including a number of different documentary films and also some years as assistant director on the television series Law and Order. Again, this documentary film airing tonight is called Tower. Keith Maitland, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really, really excited about this. Briefly, can you just say what it is like for you to create a film like this versus some of these other things that you have done, like being an assistant director on Law and Order? Those seem like, in a sense, completely different undertakings.
They are pretty different. You know, the biggest difference is that some of the work that I've done in my past has been creatively stimulating, and it's been, you know, a challenge and difficult. You know, film production is always exciting and difficult, but with Tower, there was another layer of experience that really dominated the entire 4-year process of making the film and the last year of distributing the film, which is the connection that I feel to the people who were in the film, the subjects, the real-life folks who lived through this ordeal, and the community that's been born around the 50th anniversary of the shooting, around the making of the film, and continues to grow as we take the film out into the world. And so that really separates this experience from any of my other film projects or any of my experience. I've been in the industry for almost 20 years, but these last 4 years have really been a unique opportunity for deep human connection and cathartic healing for the people involved in the story and for the community that's been born.
Right. Explain to our listeners the really interesting way in which you first became aware of this incident in Austin, Texas, back in 1966. Explain when that was and under the circumstances, and especially from whom you first learned about this.
Sure. I was born in 1975, so I was born 9 years after the shooting. So my first opportunity to learn about the shooting came when I was in seventh grade. And it was the year I moved to Texas from New Jersey. And every seventh grader in Texas is required to take Texas history for an entire year. And so it was in that Texas history class that I learned about the tower shooting. What's unique about that is not every Texas history student in the state of Texas learned about it. Very few did, actually, because the shooting is not on the statewide curriculum for that class. But the reason my class learned about it and why I first learned about it was because my teacher was on campus that day. She was an eyewitness to the shooting, and she kind of broke from the statewide curriculum to teach her own lesson on her personal experience having been a witness to this tragedy. And the story that she shared with us that day, this is back when I was 12 years old in 1988, was the story of a scared and confused young student who found herself on campus during a crisis. We wasn't sure what was happening. Saw people running, saw people hiding, heard loud sounds, finally realized they were probably gunshots, looked up to the top of the tower and saw a man with a rifle, and realized if she could see him, he could see her, and ran back into the building she was standing next to. And that feeling, that kind of gut-level, visceral reaction, that's what stuck with me for many, many years.
It's interesting, not to leap ahead here, but one of the main characters whom we hear from, and I don't mean character in the sense of someone fictional, I mean this was somebody who really was there, was a very frightened young female who describes it from that perspective, not as someone who actually herself was shot, but as someone absolutely terrified by what was going on, and in retrospect, very much troubled by her own sense of, in a sense, impotence, her reluctance to do anything except cower behind that window in fear. That almost sounds like that person we hear from in your film almost could have been your teacher.
She could have been, yes. And that's the thing, is that it wasn't a unique perspective. It's a very human perspective. You know, the shooting, like you mentioned, lasted over an hour and a half, and it happened on a very large college campus with a big student population. And so there are thousands and thousands of eyewitnesses to this crime. And so our film focuses on eight voices, two students who were shot by the sniper, two civilians who risked their lives to help others, the two police officers that you mentioned that ended the shooting, and two journalists, a professional journalist on the scene, a radio reporter who became the voice of the event, and the student journalist who watched from a window and used all of her powers of observation to kind of record what she saw that day. And that's the character that you described, Brenda Bell. And Brenda said that day, that's the moment that she realized she was a coward. And that line is, I think, something that people really relate to in this film, is that while we focus on the heroes, the victims, and the survivors of this event, there's no judgment made as to what makes somebody a hero and what allows someone to become a survivor. And so while Brenda sees herself as a coward, I see her as a survivor and someone whose self-preservation instinct kicked in that day. And I'm glad that it did, because she's still here with us.
Right. She says herself that this was a moment that separated the scared people from the brave people. And, of course, that's, in a sense, maybe a bit of a simplistic description of the scenario. And yet it's important for us to understand that that's how it felt to her then, and even all these years later, it still feels like one of those moments in which we saw people who were incredibly brave and other people who were, in a sense, too scared to be brave. Say a word about the mechanics by which you connected with some of the most significant figures in this story. And in particular, the major figures who are featured so prominently in your film. How did you find them? And describe the process by which you, in a sense, issued this invitation and ushered in their participation.
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, my first connection to the story came as a 12-year-old. Years later, I went to the University of Texas as an 18-year-old, and I expected to learn about the shooting and discovered that there was a real vacuum on campus. The story wasn't told. There wasn't a memorial on campus. The tower had been closed off So you couldn't go up and stand on the observation deck. There wasn't an opportunity to engage with this history. And so for many years, the curiosity that I had only grew because of that vacuum. But 11 years ago now, 10 and a half years ago, Texas Monthly released an article. Texas Monthly is a magazine here in Texas, and it was an oral history of that day told from the perspective of a couple dozen people on the ground in these very visceral snippets that of their memory from that day. And it was while I was reading that article that the idea to make this film was born. And so I connected with the journalist, Pamela Koloff, who created that oral history, and let her know that I wanted to make this film and the approach that I wanted to take. I asked her to join me on the process as an executive producer. And really, the very first step was Pam made an introduction to several of the people at the heart of her article that whose stories I was most intrigued by. And first and foremost, that was Claire Wilson, who is, at the time, an 18-year-old, 8-month pregnant, incoming freshman. So she has a very unique perspective as an unmarried, pregnant woman in 1966, entering a major university. She was also the very first person shot from the tower, and she survived. Her boyfriend, Tom, who was walking with her, was also shot. He did not survive. And Claire's story was really central to Pam's article. It was central to my understanding of what was happening on the ground that day. And what I discovered through the years was her story was really central to those thousands of eyewitnesses that I mentioned, because where she was shot and where she was laying on the campus was a real focal point. So all of the hundreds and thousands of people that were hiding behind trees and in classrooms, peeking out of windows, most of them could see Claire. And they could tell she was alive, and she was kind of melting into the hot pavement. So it was very important to me to connect with Claire first and foremost. And Pam made an introduction by email, and I followed it up with a phone call. And I'll be honest, I was very anxious and very nervous reaching out to Claire and all the others, because when you pick up a phone and you say to somebody, hey, you don't know me, but I'm a filmmaker, and I want to dig into the worst thing that ever happened to you 50 years ago, and I want to make a film about it. And by the way, my approach is going to be to make an animated film out of your story. It's easy to see how somebody might be apprehensive about receiving that phone call. And so my goal was to be sensitive. It was to be thoughtful, to move slowly, and to build trust. But what I discovered almost time and time again as I reached out to these folks was that because of that vacuum that had existed for so many years, nearly everyone I reached out to was anxious to talk about what they'd experienced. They were eager to explore their memory and their history and to find a way to contextualize all of this against what we see on the news all too regularly today.
This is as good a time as any for us to mention the fact that the majority of the film, although the film does include plenty of archival film footage from that terrible day, is the vast majority of what we will see on the screen is an animated depiction or portrayal of what occurred in Austin. Using what is described in some publicity materials as rotoscopic animation, and it is incredibly effective. Say, first of all, a word about why you chose animation as the tool to convey so much of this story, and maybe what this term rotoscopic animation refers to.
Well, the animation technique is something that I thought of immediately while I was reading the article. And there are several reasons for it, but the primary ones are this. The University of Texas would never allow anyone to shoot recreations of this terrible event on campus. You have to understand, this is a major university that takes up over 5 city blocks with a 27-plus story tower at the center of it. And to recreate this story on that campus wasn't an option because of the university's reluctance to get into this history, and to recreate this campus in some other location wasn't an option because there's no way it could be authentic. And as a Texas ex myself, it wasn't an option to me to create a non-authentic retelling. So the animation allowed us to transcend geography. Through this animation, we could set the events exactly where they took place, but recreate that space through artistry and hand-drawn depictions of the tower building, the campus, the South Mall, Austin as it was in 1966. So that was one of the reasons for the animation. The other reason was because I made it a very conscious decision early on that we wanted the film to be an immersive experience. We wanted it to be an experiential retelling so that audience members felt like they were really there that day. And it wasn't just B-roll looking back at an event, you know, like Civil War reenactors, you know, providing some footage for a BBC documentary on the American Civil War, but an action-oriented, visceral, emotional experience that said, what does it feel like to be in the line of fire? What does it feel like to find yourself in this crisis just as these real people did?
Right. And I think you really managed to achieve that to a remarkable degree. I fully applaud the choice. One of the choices you made in terms of using this animation is that, with one really brief, intriguing exception, all of this animation that we view is entirely in black and white. I wonder if there is anything in particular behind that choice.
Yeah, I mean, the first reason to do the film mostly in black and white is because, as you mentioned, there is a significant amount of archival footage from that day, 16-millimeter newsreel footage captured during the 90-minute siege. And to make use of that footage in a really streamlined editorial way that allowed us to mix the animation and the archival footage together, it felt like it required the animation to be black and white, just as the 16-millimeter footage was black and white. So that was the initial reason for creating the animation in that palette. But as we started working with the black and white animation, we realized it did several other things as well. You know, the entire film is based on 50-year-old memories. And I'll be the first to admit that memory is fallible. You know, I have a hard time remembering things all the time, you know. And so we're telling the story of what happened 50 years ago from the perspectives of people who were there based on years-old memories at times. And the black and white animation seemed to convey that idea in a almost intrinsic way. You know, by desaturating those moments, it created a starkness, and it allowed kind of the emotion in the characters' eyes and in the actors' portrayals to kind of stand alone. And then when we do have an opportunity to utilize color in flashbacks to before the shooting, it really makes that those colorful scenes kind of stand out, and just as those flashbacks kind of serve to break up the tragedy and serve to break up the heavy subject matter that we're very much steeped in for the first hour of the film, the color associated with those kind of really pops as your eyes have become really accustomed to the black and white palette of the animation.
Right, and of course we eventually, by the end of the film, actually see the actual faces of some of these principals, and that is of course quite striking. And I also appreciate the fact that your film spends some time at the end talking about what it has been like for some of these people to live with this, to live with the horrific memories of surviving something so terrible and tragic. I wonder if you could say a quick word about the work of a radio journalist. We've briefly mentioned him already, and the broadcasting which he did from the scene. First of all, describe what he did and what remains of what he broadcast that day and what kind of a help that was to you.
Absolutely. Well, so on August 1st, as the shooting unfolded, I already described how Claire and her boyfriend Tom were shot from the tower. Just after they were shot, because they were at the central location on campus, numerous people from campus picked up the phone and called the police. And the police department reacted quickly, sending a call out to patrol officers to head up to campus and reports of a shooting. Well, just a few blocks from police headquarters was KTBC radio studio, where the news director, Neil Speltz, was listening to the police scanner, trying to come up with something to report on this lazy, hot summer Monday. So when he hears that there's been a shooting at campus, he's intrigued, and he sends out a reporter to go cover the event. And as they start to realize that it's a bigger event than they had anticipated, he himself gets into a station wagon equipped with a mobile transmitting unit, and he drives to campus and begins reporting on the shooting from the scene while kind of cruising around the campus in this old station wagon. And just like the police officers who were heading to campus, his assumption is that the event will be over by the time he gets there. You know, most gun violence exists in a matter of moments or seconds. But as he pulls onto the campus, he very quickly understands that this is an ongoing shooting, and that really there isn't anywhere on campus that's entirely safe. And he begins warning people over the radio airwaves, stay away from campus, there's a sniper on the tower. And for the next almost hour and a half, he broadcasts live from various locations on campus, you know, kind of risking his own life to get a better vantage point from time to time. He interviews people on the scene, and he very calmly and very professionally keeps all of his listeners informed as to what is happening, even as they don't know who's at the top of the tower, how many men are at the top of the tower, what their motives are. He continues to share the stories that he's seeing, the stories that his other reporters on the scene are collecting and sliding to him through notes, and he really becomes the voice of that day. And as the shooting goes on for so long, other radio stations begin to pick up the signal and carry it from state to state across the country. And so Neil Speltz's voice becomes this ubiquitous narrator for this incredibly unprecedented event. And all the years later, when I started making the film, it was the first piece of material that I got my hands on was the original broadcast that Neil, participated in. And without that broadcast, I don't think we would have been able to make the film. The work that he was doing that day set the stage and was really the foundation for our story.
And thank goodness somebody had the foresight to hit record and preserve that so it can be part of this remarkable film. The film, again, is called Tower. It airs tonight on PBS Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on and PBS stations across the country. And then beginning tomorrow, I believe, will be available for streaming via the PBS website. It is a remarkable film. I urge everybody listening to view it any way they possibly can. The director and one of the producers, Keith Maitland. Keith Maitland, congratulations on an absolutely superb film. And thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
I really appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Part two of today's morning show, a look back at ancient Rome and Emperor Nero, coming up in just a moment. A reminder that tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be among other things, speaking with Dr. Wael Farouk, the head of piano at Carthage College, talking about the monumental Brahms project, which he is undertaking over the next 15 months, performing all of the piano music of the great Johannes Brahms. 8:35 the time here on WGTD. We are going to be readdressing a figure in history who is drastically misunderstood. It is Emperor Nero, one of Rome's most famous emperors, and unjustly blamed, it would seem, for the great fire which consumed the magnificent city of Rome in the year 64. The book is The Great Fire of Rome, The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City, and it is written by Stephen Dando Collins, with whom I spoke earlier on the morning show about a fascinating book called Tycoon's War, Vanderbilt and Walker in Nicaragua. Now, that story is a story that most of us, certainly me, had absolutely never, ever heard of. And so this, by contrast, is a very different sort of historical project in which Stephen Dando Collins is taking something that we all think we know at least a little bit about and turning it on its head, helping us understand that, in fact, presumptions that many of us make about who Nero was and what he did and what he's guilty of do not square with the historical record at all. His book is not only a story about what most likely happened with the Great Fire of Rome, but also helps us understand how this sort of fiction around Nero sprang up in the wake of this disaster. The book is published by Da Capo. Again, it's called The Great Fire of Rome, The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City. And Stephen Dando Collins, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Good to be with you again.
I am so happy about this opportunity to speak with you. Are you struck as I am by the difference between these two books and kind of what each of them represents in terms of us not knowing our history as well as we should?
Yeah, very much so. This is actually my eighth book on Roman history. The ninth, in fact, is being published in the UK next month by a different publisher and on a different subject. So I've had several different historical streams running for some years now. One, as I say, has been Roman history, and the other has been American history. So the two books you mentioned are examples of both streams.
In this case, of course, we're talking about something that most people know at least a little bit about, but the little we presume to know seems to not, in fact, be correct. First of all, help us understand better than we otherwise do the importance of Rome at its heyday and what its state of affairs was at the time of the Great Fire in 64. Was it still in its heyday, or was Rome already very much in its decline?
No, you're right. It was indeed its heyday. The first century was the golden era of Rome. We are talking about Nero, the last of the Caesar family. But prior to him, we had Claudius and Caligula and Tiberius and Augustus, the first of Rome's emperors. So we're fairly early into the imperial era, and Rome is really at its zenith in terms of power and wealth. And by this stage, Britain has been invaded for 17 years. And is in the Roman fold. The Roman power extends throughout the Mediterranean, right throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and it is, you know, the superpower of its age.
The story of the Emperor Nero's rise to the throne is intriguing, for no other reason than the fact that he is acclaimed emperor at the tender age of 17. Yeah. I don't know that that makes him the youngest of all emperors, but certainly it's a little bewildering for us to imagine the mantle of such responsibility being laid on the shoulders of someone so young.
True, but he was not unprepared. He had known for several years that he was destined to be the heir and successor of his uncle Claudius. And he had for many years as his tutor, Seneca, the famous philosopher who schooled him very well. And so by the time he came to the throne, he was an accomplished public speaker, even if his speeches were written for him by Seneca. And he had a very good management team around him, with Seneca as his chief secretary, his secretary, his, you know, running his White House, if you like, and the head of the military was a guy called Burrus, who was his like his secretary of defense, and they were both very able men. So he had a good team around him. He had the training. He had seen how the palace worked from the inside, the good and the bad, as he grew up. And so he was not unprepared, but as you say, it was a tender age. But let us remember that Roman men came of age at the age of 16, unlike, you know, 21 or whatever today. So they were prepared for civic life very early.
Tell us about his tremendous love for, and we presume talent, for music, and the kind of competitions which he was inclined to enter, including the one which he was competing in at the time that this fire broke out in Rome. Tell us more about Nero the musician.
He was vilified after his death by various Roman writers who poked fun at him and said that he wasn't much of a singer, but he certainly applied himself. He trained himself as a singer. All the members of the imperial family, you know, a lot of them didn't have much to do in the palace when they were growing up. So they took on all sorts of training. The emperor Claudius was a well-known poet and historian, and likewise with Nero, he took an interest in singing and trained his voice. Went off the sorts of food that it was thought were detrimental to the voice, like apples, and among the other things that that were done to train the voice, a singer would lie on the floor and a piece of lead would be put on the chest that apparently helped their breathing and improved their singing, and he became quite an accomplished singer and longed to compete in the public singing contests, particularly in Greece. Greece was the home of the arts, and all the major games in Greece, including the Olympic Games, excluding the Olympic Games, but all the other public games, featured singing contests, poets, heralds, and so on. And he longed to compete on stage to prove that he was the, you know, the equal or even the, you know, better than the other contestants. But the people around him at the palace were disinclined to let him go on the public stage. They worried that this would demean his status. And in my book, I liken him to it would be a little like an American president deciding to compete on American Idol. It was not quite done, so they very successfully convinced him to initially, if he was going to sing in public, do it at out of the way venues in country towns. But he fully intended to, and later did, after several years later after the Great Fire, ended up competing in all the major contests in Greece and won them. Whether it was because he had a good voice or whether because no one dared not give him the prize, we don't really know.
Speaking of what we don't really know, of course, one of the challenges which you face and others who write about Rome is that there are conflicting accounts and often accounts which were written to make a very specific sort of political point rather than to recount exactly what happened. And certainly your book helps us to try at least to untangle that knot when it comes to as divisive a figure as Nero. Before we even talk about the fire, could you just speak a word about the historical accounts of this period and about Nero and what one is to make of them. I mean, what use are they in trying to unlock the truth?
Well, of course, without them, we wouldn't know that there had been a great fire. You know, some people say, oh, we should ignore the old classical accounts because they're either biased or are incorrect, and we should only go by modern analysis. Well, there would be no modern analysis without these classical accounts, so they can't be discounted, and they have to be carefully analysed. Each author of the day had their own agenda, their own barrow to push. But the most we know about the Great Fire comes from the Roman historian Tacitus, who was a boy at the time, living in Rome at the time of the Great Fire. He was highly critical of Nero when he wrote his histories, but he was, in many respects, the most reliable of the Roman historians, because while his bias came through, he tended to stick with the facts. Some of the other authors who wrote about Nero, Suetonius, he wrote about the first 12 Caesars. I think if he were alive today, he'd write Pulp Fiction, because his works were full of all the most scurrilous detail he could put in. And it's from him that we know so many colourful details about the likes of Caligula and Claudius and Nero. And we're not entirely sure how much of this was pure gossip and how much was fact. There were several other authors, classical authors, Cassius Dio. He wrote 150 years after the fact, and he tended to rely a lot on these earlier authors. And in fact, if you read his works about the first century, it's possible to see how he lifted whole tracts from the likes of Tacitus and put them in his own later histories. And there are several other authors, Josephus, the Jewish author who was alive at the time and living at Rome at the time of the Great Fire. He gives us some interesting detail as well. So, and there are one or two other authors that give us smaller details. We also know that people like the poet Martial was living at Rome at the time. So that there are various sources, and so the job of the scholar and the author today is to take those sources and try and make sense of them. And this is what I've tried to do in this book. I was amazed, I have to say, that there's been no book written about the Great Fire of Rome as such. There have been lots of histories about Nero and this period, but no book really focused on the fire and on the political ramifications of the fire.
Hmm. I find that astonishing as well. Well, whoever or whatever was responsible for the fire in terms of what or who might have started it, it seems fairly clear that Nero was nowhere on site when the fire broke out. He was at one of these competitions, but you tell us he went back to Rome very, very quickly and oversaw efforts of relief and so on as best he could. Explain just how massive and significant this fire was in terms of how much of the city was affected and destroyed.
Fires were common in Rome. Once a decade, roughly, there would be a major fire that would wipe out an entire suburb. You can imagine the economy of Rome was totally based on the open fire, from bakeries to workshops. And it was not uncommon for fires to break out. And Rome didn't have a fire brigade as we know it today. They had troops whose job it was to try and fight fires, but with buckets of water. So the firefighting capacity was low. So it was no surprise when a fire broke out, and also there were stories that landlords, when they decided that they could make more profit by demolishing their property and then putting up the rents significantly when they rebuilt, were reputed to set fires in their own properties. So when the news first arrived, reached Nero that there was a fire at Rome, he didn't steps to leave Antium, or Anzio, as we know it today, on the west coast of Italy, where he was they'll bring it under control like all the other fires. It won't be a problem. But the next report he received was that the fire is totally out of control. It started in the Circus Maximus. The wind has blown it away. It's destroyed the circus, which was the largest wooden building ever built. You can imagine being all wood apart from the stone foundations. It burnt readily. And then the very strong wind blew it to the Aventine Hill, which was a major suburb of the elite, and then to surrounding areas. And then the wind changed and blew it back the other way, and so that it headed toward the remainder of Rome. And the fire initially burned for 5 days, and when the second report reached Nero, he realised that it was no small fire, and he told his entourage, we're heading back to the city. But when he arrived back, it was defined that there were hundreds of thousands of refugees had fled the city. The reports don't indicate that there was a great loss of life, so there seems to have been time for the majority of the people in the path of the fire to get out of its way. Some reports say that the elderly and the stubborn who didn't want to leave their homes were consumed by the fire. So the actual death toll wasn't all that high, but the damage was extensive. And then the fire broke out anew when they thought it was at an end. The only real firefighting measures that work were to actually level buildings, whole streets of buildings in the path of the fire, and this is what they did, and that seemed to work. And then the fire broke out anew at the base of the Capitoline Mount and swept up that hill and burned for another 2 days. So by the time the fire had finally been extinguished after a week, only 4 of the 14 precincts of Rome were totally untouched by the fire. All the central part of the city, all the ancient temples, which are hundreds of years old, all the public buildings, and Nero's own palace had all been totally destroyed. This, as I say, it's aptly called the Great Fire of Rome. It was immense.
Mm. In one of the reasons, it would seem that Nero has been unjustly blamed for either not caring about the fire or perhaps even being a party in starting it. Some suggested it was so he could build a new palace. But one of the reasons for him attracting blame is because of the way in which he assigned blame. Explain to our listeners who he publicly blamed for the fire of Rome and what he did in terms of acting on that presumed blame.
This is probably the most controversial aspect of the entire story of the Great Fire of Rome. The only reference to this is in Tacitus, in his annals, and as I said earlier, he is generally regarded as a very reliable historian. His facts tend to add up, and he worked from the official records of the day, but in the middle of the story of the Great Fire, there's this account in the versions of his annals that will come down to us that he fixed the blame on the Christians at Rome, and he had, according to this paragraph, had a multitude arrested and then persecuted them, sent some into the arena to be devoured by the wild beasts, and burned others on crosses. But many scholars believe that this was inserted later by Christian copyists. In those days, there were no printing presses. This year, we were a long way before the invention of the printing press. And the way that books were produced, clerks would sit down and handwrite every book. And so you would go to the local bookstore, and here would be these rolls of parchment which had been handwritten very artfully, and this was how you read your books. And so every single copy was handmade, handwritten. And so it was quite easy, as new copies were made, for someone to change the text, to insert whatever they liked. And it suggested that perhaps 100, 200 years, 300 years later, somebody inserted this reference to the Christians. Some scholars believe that this entire reference was invented. Others wonder where maybe some of it was factual, but some of the details were changed by the later writers. And it's interesting that the reasons or the text that says the Christians were punished. If you replace the word Christians with the Egyptians, this was a title given to the followers of Isis, an Egyptian goddess, which had grown very large at Rome by this stage, but it was looked at, down upon by the elite. It was mostly followed by slaves and ex-slaves. There were many thousands of followers at Rome at this time. And when you read this passage in Tacitus, it talks about that to humiliate them, some were attacked by dogs in the arena, and others were burned. Now, Anubis, one of the gods associated with the followers of Isis, actually wore a dog's head. It also said that they were covered in animal skins, and the followers of Isis eschewed animal skins. They even wore parchment sandals, so they didn't even have leather on their body. So it's possible that if Nero did in fact punish a whole group of people, a whole class of people, for setting the Great Fire of Rome, to take the blame from his own shoulders, it's far from being the Christians, it may have been these followers of Isis, if it occurred at all.
It is so intriguing to think about, in a sense, kind of the liquid nature of history, or the tenuous nature of the historical record. And, of course, one of the things that's so interesting about your book is that you are not only trying to give us, in a sense, your best judgment about some of these intriguing questions, but just by laying out kind of the messiness of these conflicting historical accounts, or the possible conflicts of interest or hidden motivations that might have led to the rewriting of history, as it were. I mean, that in and of itself is a fascinating story, even apart from the city of Rome nearly burning to the ground.
It is indeed, and it's something for you know, the historical writer, for the researcher, for the historian, it's something of a treasure hunt, pulling all these pieces of information together, and then and ultimately it comes down to the writer to make the decision, what they believe is the most likely truth to be found there. But you know, history is full of many truths, so you know, I challenge my readers to think and to take on board all potential arguments. So I do set out in the introduction to this book, the conflicting accounts and the different ways that they could be interpreted, and then I give my interpretation.
The book again is called The Great Fire of Rome: The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City. The book is published by Da Capo, and its author Stephen Dando Collins. I thank you so much for joining me today. You have written yet again a fascinating book, and I'm glad we could talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I've enjoyed it.
Tomorrow's morning show will be opening with a conversation with Dr. Wael Farouk, who is the head of piano studies at Carthage College. Dr. Farouk has decided to undertake something which he is calling the Brahms Project. And over the course of the next 15 months, he is going to be engaged in a series of recitals and concerts which will feature all of the piano music written by the great composer Johannes Brahms. The first of these recitals is going to be occurring this Saturday evening, and the next will be the following Friday night. And on tomorrow's morning show, you'll hear Dr. Farouk's thoughts on the piano music of Johannes Brahms, and you'll even get to hear him play a little bit. And we'll take a moment to allow you to hear the voice